Good day and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies, hosted by Tara Anjaria out of Bombay, India. Our guest today is Eugenia Herbert, and she is going to take us to the tropical and not so tropical gardens of the Indian subcontinent. Well, those gardens planted or restored by the British anyway. Everyone knows the story of the Indian civilian who had to plant English flowers in flower pots so he could take them along when he was invariably transferred to yet another station. Everyone knows how landscapes were crafted and designed to evoke not just home, but imperial grandeur. Austere stretches of lawn leading up to impressive edifices are characteristic of the period. But more than that, Eugenia is going to tell us how one British viceroy in particular painstakingly restored the Taj Mahal and its gardens with spectacular results, but how the final restored product was very different from what it would have been in the days of those who built it. Good morning, Professor Herbert.
Good morning to you.
Oh, and thank you very much for doing this for the New Books Network. It's a pleasure to have you with us today. This is a very offbeat book, and I'm sure it's going to be very interesting for our readers.
Good, and for me too.
Yeah. So could you tell us something about yourself and your career to date, because you've had a long career?
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
It looks a little curious too, but I think in retrospect there was always a connection. I worked in African history for many years, although my PhD was in European history, but I won't go that far back. Anyway, I was working in African history, and for a long time I worked on the history of African metallurgy because it seemed to be a way to tie in so many aspects of the history. But then by the early 1990s, I'd done a lot of field work in Africa with metallurgists, smelters, copper workers, brass casters, that sort of thing. By the early 1990s, everyone who remembered the indigenous methods had died. So I was looking around for a way to continue research in Africa, and I realized that a lot of my sources for that had been, in fact, colonial officials who were curious about things. And I got interested particularly through one contact who had written a fascinating article about a reconstruction. And I started looking at colonial culture in British Africa, and did a book that came out in 2002 about late colonialism in the Upper Zambezi. And in the course of reading lots of memoirs and letters, I was struck by the fact how important gardens were. And I guess I hadn't really registered that, of course, they would be. There were lots of reasons. But then through an old college friend, I became interested in India, which I'm afraid I knew very little about before that. And I thought, well, if gardens were so important and colonial culture in Africa, which was so much shorter and involved so many fewer people, what about India? And so that was the reason for my focus on the colonial gardens and the gardens as a kind of microcosm of the evolution of British colonial culture in India. And of course, once I got started, it went off in all sorts of directions, which I really enjoyed tremendously, and it gave me an opportunity to visit India, and every trip seemed to be more fascinating than the last. So there was a kind of bridge between my researches in Africa and in India, and the gardens just sort of jump out at you when you look. There's hardly a memoir, hardly a set of letters that doesn't refer to gardens. They're just everywhere. The domestic gardens, the public gardens, the botanical gardens, the hill station gardens, you know, you've seen where it led. And I had no idea at the beginning, of course. I thought there might be one essay or article that would be interesting. And I thought it would mostly focus on nostalgia. And of course, nostalgia is only one dimension. There are many more, I think, to it. So that's sort of how I ended up with that.
Yeah.
Is that reasonable?
Yeah, so, but I think this is something that has really not been researched before. So how did this book take shape?
Well, yes, exactly. It took shape really almost serendipitously. That is, one topic led to another. When I guess it was the first trip to India in 2003, when I, of course, visited the Taj Mahal, and then I was interested in the origins of the Taj Mahal, especially the whole Mughal tradition where the gardens were really the starting point, and then the architectural features came later. But from the West, at least, most people look at architecture and then look at the setting. But that was the Mughal aesthetic. And then, of course, looking, there's so much documentation, so many illustrations from the 1780s on of the Taj Mahal, right through to, of course, the present and the Curzon. And you know the whole Curzon episode, I think, from your own work and his interest. And then visiting other sites like Khajuraho or Sarnath, I realized that there is a basic problem. You have to landscape them, or at least people figure you do. And yet you also have to reckon that there are going to be hundreds of thousands, case of Taj, millions of visitors. And how do you reconcile that? And I think that Curzon, of course, couldn't have anticipated the flood of tourists now. So part of his restoration, part of his restoration was his own aesthetic, and part of it was the recognition that this was going to have an entirely different use. The Mughals, after all, did not support public gardens. They didn't let people into the Taj Gardens except on the anniversary of Mumtaz Mahal's death. So there's it's not only aesthetics, it's also the changing use, the changing conceptions of these spaces. And when a monument becomes a public park, it's a whole different animal. Anyway, but of course, you can't start looking at British culture without the hill stations. So one thing sort of followed from another. And that was the fun of course, to see where it was going to go, which I had no idea when I began.
Could you start off by telling us something, you know, about, the setting to which the British in India came, the kind of, horticultural tradition they encountered? I mean, their first, interactions with the Indian landscaping scene.
Yes, well, of course, the presidency cities, I don't think, the earliest factory was in Surat, and there they did encounter, I think, an extension of the Mughal tradition in the extreme northwest corner there, because James Forbes does refer to gardens there. He doesn't give a great deal of description, but I suspect that they were based, that they were geometric and probably walled. It's not clear. I think that the British had very little understanding of the role of gardens in Hindu culture. I think they sort of thought of the Mughal gardens that stood out because of their geometry, and that would have been clear. But Hindu gardens, I think they thought of as just sort of a mass of shrubs. There's not many descriptions of those early on. And of course, it wasn't until William Jones that they really had a way into the literature, into the dramas of Kalidasa and some of the other literature that brings out the whole courtly tradition of gardens and the scented garden and the seductions of the garden, that sort of thing. But I think that was later in coming. So I think at first they had somewhat Babur's reaction that this was a land of chaos and runaway exotics, and they needed to tame them rather than a sense of a non-Mughal tradition of gardening.
But you say that the earliest gardens, you know, they were actually established in the metropole and in an urban space like Calcutta, for example, or Bombay. I mean, that's kind of interesting because that's not really what happened with the Mughals, I think.
No, that's right. That's right. Yes, yes. And of course, Madras, people sort of forget, I think, the importance of Madras. Because it became overshadowed by Calcutta and then Bombay. But the garden house tradition was very much the extension of England, where you would have a house in the city and then you would have a place in the country. And especially it would show you off that you had made it if you could afford to be a landed gentry. And so I think that Madras becomes sort of the prototype for the garden house, which is then followed in Calcutta even more splendidly, and to some extent in Bombay, but it was harder to get outside of Bombay because of the geography. You're in Mumbai now, right? In Mumbai.
Yeah. And actually, the botanical gardens, they still exist, you know, but I think they're part of the zoo now. But that's not the case with Calcutta, because I think the Calcutta gardens are still very famous.
They're very famous and still very expensive, yes. I have the feeling when I was there a couple of years ago that they're suffering a bit from lack of funding, but everything else is too. But they're still well kept up, and they're reasonably well kept up, and, you know, lots of people visit them. Yeah. Yeah. And of course, botanical gardens had very practical uses, with the whole emphasis in the late 18th century on useful knowledge. That and people sort of forget that botany was the queen of the sciences until it was replaced in the 19th century by geology and much later by physics and others. And it did have so many practical ramifications, because if you understood the natural world, you would find all sorts of useful plants. And early on, I think more than later, the British appreciated the botanical knowledge that Indians had. They didn't consider themselves superior, and botanists would really make a point of getting in touch with people with herbal knowledge and then trying to make catalogs of the plants and their uses. And of course, herbal medicine was common in Europe too, but I think they recognized that in many ways the Indian knowledge of herbal remedies was in advance of Europe. Mm-hmm. I think that changed so much in the 19th century, where there's such a sense of superiority coming in and that they were more scientific and all that. But I think also what interested me was to see change over time. And there's change in the garden traditions, from the garden house to the bungalow garden, that corresponds, of course, with the changing administration from the commercial empire to the administrative empire, all those and many more people coming. And then later, as people become more transient too, there's a change. So I think the historian is always looking for how things change, and not just for a model that is set in time. And then,
So I was just wondering, I mean, it's like sometime around the mid-18th century or the early 19th century, that's when the English kind of, you know, dropped off the more Indianizing ways. I mean, there was an added emphasis on being English, you know, and not actually conforming to native customs. So was this the time when, like, the tradition of, like, planting, you know, gardens that were very, you know, visibly English took hold?
I think there is a rough parallel with that, yes. And the interesting point then become the exceptions, because I think the mode was to try to replicate England more and more. Yeah, you know, say the sort of corresponding to the period where there are fewer of the white Mughals, as Dalrymple would call them, and more separation of the English from Indian culture. But then you find exceptions. I mean, you find people like Fanny Parkes, and I think the exceptions were especially people who were there a long time and who had a kind of built-in curiosity. I mean, I like Fanny Parkes because she comes with all the Mem Sahib prejudices at first, and then the more she travels, the more she comes caught up in India, and it becomes very hard for her to go back home. And her focus is so much on the natural world as well as on people. And I think there are others like that. So that there's always a kind of stereotype, but then the exceptions are the fun, or the people, even somebody who was very much in the mold later, say Lady Beatrix Stanley. And I had some insights into her because I know her grandson in England, that she was very much cocooned in official society. And yet, because she had a great interest, which a lot of women did, in botany, she made a list of the plants that would grow and the plants that wouldn't grow. And she says, you're just silly to try to grow everything there. And she was aware that the climate of Madras was quite different from the climate of Delhi, too, which people from outside would have thought, well, they're the same. But, of course, they aren't at all.
So what was the supply chain situation? Yeah, I mean, how did people import, like, you know, English seeds and English plants? I mean, was there some kind of official, like, gardening suppliers or something?
Yes, there were big importers, yes. And what people discovered, of course, they thought once they had planted English seeds, then they could make their own seeds. But there seemed to be a degeneration so that you really couldn't do that, which was great for the importers because they had a constant market. At first, it was very hard to import seeds because of the long sea voyage, and they would rot and get moldy. And so it was not all that easy. I think later it did become easier for the plants to survive. And then people took advantage of it and would grow things. You do find a lot of conflicting views. Some people say, oh, I just gave up. I just couldn't get anything English grow. And other people say, well, yes, you could. But at Calcutta, I think, was pretty hard to have an English garden. And that's why I just love people like Lady Canning, who said, India should be India. And she just was furious when she would see places that tried to mimic Hyde Park or others, and in Barrackpore. She didn't want it to look like an English country estate. So I think it's the exceptions that are kind of the fun, which doesn't deny that, I mean, who knows, you can't make a quantitative analysis, but I'm sure for many it was part of the expatriate mentality and living cocoon. And societies that became more and more separate, especially after 57, 58, after the uprising, then no doubt that part of the reaction against India reflected itself in the gardens and the parks. But by that time, of course, a lot of the Indians, princes and others, are mimicking the British. So it reinforces it.
So that was just in terms of the kind of flora that they used. You mentioned a lot about, trends in gardening, trends in landscaping. Could you tell us something about that?
Yes. I think what I expected to find more was because the garden history of England escalates in a way. Late 19th century with the Capability Brown and, the landscape, the natural landscape, which isn't natural at all. But then by the 19th century, it is just a cascade because of the intense historicism. There's the mode for the English garden, and then the reaction against that, and the topiary, and the statuary, and all of these competing views. And I don't find much reflection of that in India. And I think it's because, for one thing, people in the Indian Civil Service, there was a turn. They kept being moved. So you couldn't do anything too elaborate. You couldn't afford to. It's very expensive, of course, to establish a garden. So I think they sort of concentrated on essentials and didn't worry about following the modes. I think also there was the inevitable time lag, too. They didn't quite know what the latest battles were about. And they found some things which they tried to mimic, like the herbaceous border, just didn't work. You just couldn't get things to bloom in the proper sequence. It's important. That's late 19th century, but even the carpet gardening, all of that depended on color combinations and things, it just didn't work. So I think it was a combination of not feeling it was worth the effort, of knowing you were going to be transient and who knows what. So there's much less of that than I sort of expected, and the reasons in the end seem pretty logical why they wouldn't try to mimic that. Those things, and it just seemed less important, I'm sure, too, to them. You tried to get something to grow that you really liked, and if you could get some flowers to grow, and an acceptance that you would have to plant Indian shrubs and flowering trees, that kind of thing, in your garden, because you certainly couldn't have British trees. That was a given. The flowers were a little more problematic.
So, obviously, hill stations were the major site of activity for all this, I think.
Yes, and it was certainly one of the attractions of the hill station. Mm-hmm. What is sort of appalling when you read accounts is that so many of the flowers that had become familiar, many of them, of course, were imports into England, were growing wild in the hill stations, and there was just they just ravaged the hillside, digging them up to plant in their gardens. And that's, in retrospect, just appalling that they could go out. Of course, they would have their shivering servants digging them up and then planting them in their gardens. Of course, they would grow. But it left very little growing wild after a while. And the hill stations, I think, were awfully rainy, but that doesn't seem to have bothered the English because they were used to it. And of course, they were precipitous too. The accounts are really quite amusing of trying to find the level bit. So that was the drawback. You could get anything to grow if you had enough flat ground to grow it on, and if you could keep the invading quid out. But the hill stations loomed so large by already 1830s, 40s, and then when the Shimla became the official summer capital in 1860s. So yes, I think they are very, and they intensify the Englishness of people's responses, if anything. And some of it is, there again, they're the exception. Some people, Lady Canning hated Shimla. Others did, of course, Curzon didn't like Shimla. He retreated to, as you know, partly because you couldn't get away from, I'm sure, from shop talk all the time. And what Kipling brings out so much, the backbiting and the gossip, it must have been impossible. And people were so conscious of status, you couldn't really get away unless you moved. Had to go to a place farther out than Shimla.
Apart from Shimla, could you tell us something about the hill station? I think the ones in South India, the ones in Western India.
Yes, well, of course, Udi was different in a way, and it was more like England because it's not the rugged foothills of the Himalayas. And I think that was sort of the for people within range from Bombay. Well, Bombay tended to have its own. And I haven't been to some of the ones around Pune and in the Western Ghats, but Udi does strike me as much more suitable for those who could get there if you really wanted a kind of English environment. Mm-hmm. But of course, then something else that I didn't realize till I was reading was that there was so much deforestation in Udi because of the expanding population. There had just been the tribal peoples in the hills, but when you start bringing in massive numbers of people and all that goes with them, and the deforestation, then that probably ill-guided attempt to reforest, but using quick-growing Australian trees, so that it changed the ecology, and it's neither English nor Indian. And Udi, it's funny, I was in Udi also in 2003, and to me now it has a kind of lack of center and lack of focus, and I don't know if that was always true. It's sort of hard. Sorry, it's not like the mall in Shimla where you know where the center of things is. It's sort of the hills and the valleys in between, and it still strikes me as pockets of Englishness. The race course, so that could be Indian too, but places like the Savoy Hotel and such that are still very English. And of course, it's much changed by tea, which was late 19th century, and the market gardening. So that it's a little hard to read back precisely how it would have looked at the height of the Raj. Some watercolors from the 1840s and 50s, and Lady Canning's descriptions, others as well there. But in a way, it was the ideal hill station because it was more manageable than the Himalayas. Then, and Darjeeling too. It's curious as Lady Canning said, why Shimla became the official summer capital instead of Darjeeling, which is so much closer to Calcutta and would have served just as well. And the best explanation seems to have been that the Boxwallas got there first and the officials were not going to mix with them because the journey was so much shorter, even though you did have to go through that pestilential stretch of the Terai. But Shimla is an ungodly distance from Calcutta. It just boggles my mind that they would go with their huge trains and then the poor servants who were completely unprepared for the cold. It was, I think, one of the most amazing phenomena that I can imagine. I don't know if there are even parallels of that kind of mass migration and the foolhardiness of it, the wastefulness and the expense. And yet, they took it. Of course, the Mughals would move en masse to Kashmir with just as many people as the British, but they didn't take grand pianos along, I don't think.
Yeah, that's actually quite funny when you come to think about it. I mean, Simla is really far away. But the one thing I was interested in, you mentioned that a lot of, like, you know, Australian trees were imported into Ooty. I mean, what is the reason behind this?
Well, I think, of course, by that time, the British had the whole empire to draw on. And I think that they grew fast, for one thing. And but I don't know the actual reason, but I'm not... It may have been even more individual that the people who were involved knew Australia, because otherwise you'd think they would have found other trees that would grow. But I think it's most likely that because of the imperial connections, they knew those gum trees and they knew they would grow in that environment.
But going back to Simla, I mean, a lot of people seem to have disliked it pretty much.
Yes, they do. Yeah. And you think even more, and yet they kept going. Well, you sort of have to be seen there. And officials had to go, I think, once it became the official. I mean, there was nobody left in Calcutta. So you kind of had to go there. But it does sound most unpleasant. And for wives, just the endless round of parties with the same people. Got to be more of them eventually, but at first it was just the same handful of people day after day. And I can't imagine. It was not great even being a Mem Sahib, I would think. They must have been bored to death. They weren't allowed to do anything. Fortunately, some of them had interests like botany, but very few had any language skills, I think, to be able to communicate. There were some exceptions, obviously, but it must have been a privileged but utterly boring life.
And I think Curzon had quite a lot to say about Simla.
Yes, he did. Well, you would know more about that. Why did he hate it so much?
Oh, I don't know. I think it just sounded stifling. That's what he says.
He just says that. Yeah, so he retreated to...
And actually, in a way, I just think it was a lack of space. But when you think about it, I mean, as a viceroy, he would have been surrounded by pretty much the same people, whether he was in Calcutta or whether he was in Simla.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And of course, the work never let up. And the boxes kept arriving, I'm sure. But and of course, he had the other reason, his dislike of Kitchener, who was over on the next hill, right? He seemed to have been bothered more by Kitchener's presence than Kitchener by Curzon's, or that's the impression I had, but it wasn't really big enough for the two of them.
So in that way, it's surprising that Curzon didn't really make any alterations to Simla.
No, that's right. Yes, he wasn't going to, whereas he did, of course, cut to the governor's, to government house in Calcutta, that because he loved Calcutta. Of course, that's interesting, too. And you must have found out more about that, that he was one of the few people who genuinely loved Calcutta. And that certainly comes out in his fury at the moving the capital to Delhi. But I think he would, if he'd been able, I think he would have stayed right through the summer in Calcutta, don't you? Of course, his poor wife suffered, but...
Yeah, definitely. I mean, she said, I mean, India would kill her. And in a way, I suppose it did.
It did. It certainly did. Yes. I think it was more than just the drains when she got back. Yeah.
But despite all that, I mean, Curzon, again, well, apart from the Victoria Memorial, he concentrated most of his energies on Agra and obviously on the Taj complex.
Yes. And of course, on the ancient monuments, considering how many ancient monuments there are, it, certainly his great love was Agra, but it's amazing how many he tried to encompass in the archaeological survey of India. I mean, he did realize what a stupendous job it was. Mm-hmm. I think what's too bad is that he either didn't try or wasn't able to do more in getting those awful barracks out of the Red Fort in Delhi, because I think they're, you know, there's such an eyesight. Maybe it was because Agra was more important to him and there was a Red Fort there and he didn't have to worry about the one although, of course, he did when he had the Durbar, he did then clear out some of that so they could have that grand finale at the Diwan-e Khas there. But he didn't worry about the backdrop of all those awful barracks. But, of course, maybe that would have meant tangling with Kitchener again. I don't know.
That could tell us something about, you know, Curzon and the Taj, because that's actually something, I mean, everybody knows Curzon restored the Taj, but nobody really goes into the garden aspect of it.
Right, and that was so fun, because I think there are a fair number of word descriptions from the time that it was, well, going back even farther, it's been quite well established, the whole tradition of the riverfront garden. Cook and other people have done a wonderful job in delineating what gardens meant in Mughal culture and what they looked like. And then when the Taj gardens themselves were being laid out, there are a couple of descriptions along the way, and then Bernier's description in 1660, which is fairly complete and probably fairly accurate, the word description. And then already, and of course, then the Mughals fell on hard times in the first half of the 18th century. But when the British artists start coming through, there's just a wonderful range of illustrations, some well-known like Hodges and the Daniels and others. But just about everybody wanted to paint the Taj Mahal. So there's a wonderful record, more than I could reproduce in the book, but I've done a couple of readings and I've been able to show more of them. So that by the time the gardens, by the time Curzon first visited it in 1887-88, it was, everything had grown and grown almost too much, so that it must have been incredibly dense. But also a lot of it was fruit orchard, with good reason. This was part and parcel, the practicality of the Mughal garden. You would use the sale of fruit to defray the cost of upkeep. And it does appear that the British, well, I guess you can, it was contradictory. The British maintained the Taj, unlike a lot of other monuments, pretty well through the 19th century. It seems to be a myth that they really did dismantle some of it, or that Bentinck was going to sell off the marbles or anything. Mm-hmm. But they did use the grounds in ways that shock us. They would have picnics and parties and revelries of all sorts, including gatherings right up on the platform of the tomb itself. But they seem to have kept up the garden. And when Curzon's journal, you probably read that in the course of your work, he just can't stop going back to the Taj. And his friend, St. John Brodick, I think, got a little bored. And he would go at sunset, he would go at sunrise, keep going, and just ecstatic about it. And he praises the gardens, which he thinks, of course, entirely the work of the British gardener. But in any case, he finds no fault with the upkeep at that point and with the condition of the monument itself. And that's why I found it so startling when he becomes viceroy that one of the first things he says is, we've got to clear this place. And of course, the effect would have been entirely different. There are descriptions before it was landscaped. There's Russell's description when he took the Prince of Wales through in 76, that instead of having the clear vista from the entrance from the Taj Ganj, the clear vista, your eyes following that central channel and the fountains right down to the platform and the tomb itself, there would have been an element of mystery and surprise, which would have been, I don't know if it would have been calculated by the original landscapers or not. I don't think so. But so that you entered, you saw all of these trees, you were led down this path, and then suddenly you get to the point where the vista opens up. And the drama of that, which some people thought was superb, intended or not, that that's the way it should have been seen. It was then just the miracle of the Taj and the brilliance of the white against the sky. And then, but Curzon, who had loved it so much the way it was in the late 80s, apparently didn't want that. And he wanted it to be open. He wanted to control the prospect that people would see, that they would come in And they would come in from the outside not knowing. And then the surprise would be the minute they stepped through the Taj Gange. And then their eyes would be directed. And it didn't much matter what was on the site. Well, he did focus a lot on the plantings, especially the cypresses, along that main channel between the Taj Gange and the tomb. And he kept changing the plant. He was a pain in the neck. Everybody would groan when he came through because he would say, no, I didn't say to do it this way, do it that way. And they felt they had to run and do it. But I think all of that was to guide the eye the way, exactly the way that he thought it should go. And he wasn't interested in flowers, which is kind of interesting. He kept the quadrants, of course, but he didn't worry that much. Well, the main thing that is lost, and you have to give him credit, that he did realize that there would be a lot of people, and you had to figure out how to protect the whole setting. There were lots of people. Didn't anticipate 3 million, of course. But it seems to me that he had no sensitivity to the complex. He was thinking just in visual terms. And he read Bernier. He read these other sources. It's hard to know how much he read beyond the obvious. He does refer to Bernier and some of the others. But he doesn't seem to have cared at all about the sense of smell and sound, which was so important, especially smell. But when you have all of those fruit trees, you also have lots of birds. So that ideally it would have been just a feast for the senses. And that's not true now. And times I've asked people, whenever they've been to visit the Taj Mahal, I say, what do you remember of the gardens? And they scratch their heads and they say, well, it was just a setting. They don't remember anything in particular. And I think that's a great loss because they don't even realize they're in a Mughal garden. And in fact, one of the great Mughal gardens. After all, it would have been one of the climactic gardens under Shah Jahan, who was so obsessed with gardens. And then the tomb garden as the quintessential Mughal garden as it evolved in the first century or century and a bit of Mughal rule. So I think it's too bad that is lost. In a way, it's a dilemma now. And of course, there have been these awful attempts to commercialize the Taj even more and the surrounding things and misguided attempts by landscape departments and such. But I don't think you could go back to a Mughal garden and still have the volume of tourists you have now. It couldn't accommodate them. So you're in a bind more than I think Curzon was conscious of. I think it's much more his own aesthetic and his own focus on architecture rather than garden per se that was important in his restoration. And I think you see that in other sites too, where there are the walks, there are the lawns, there are a few shade trees, but there's not any attempt to, of course, in Hindu sites like Khajuraho, nobody has a clue how they would have been landscaped, but I think there would have been a lot of temple flowers growing there.
One of the interesting things about Curzon was that, I mean, one of his biographers noted that he had this idea that a landscaped garden or a landscaped environment was much better than something that was, you know, in a more natural state. So was this something that could have influenced, you know, his restoration of the Taj?
Yes, I'm sure. Yes, yes. And when you go to Kettleston, it's in a kind of a time warp because it's still that pseudo-natural environment of the rolling hills, the stream that has been redirected just the right way, the sheep there. And there is a little flower garden, but it doesn't amount to much. And I don't think it's been changed. But it was interesting that he did consult Edwin Lutyens in the 20s about redoing the garden, but they did it never came to anything. So I think he was not that interested in landscape. Of course, he felt he had every right because landscapes change. You could fix architecture the way it was, but landscapes are going to change anyway because things grow. So I think he was trying to think of something that would maintain itself as he wanted it as long as possible. And it has been kept up pretty much that way. I mean, the illustrations from 1918, 1919, the photographs are pretty similar. to the way it looks now.
It's going on to the building of Delhi. Obviously, this was a capital that Curzon hated, but this was something that... what is a certain amount of change in British attitudes towards, landscaping the Indian space, between Curzon and the building of Delhi?
Yes. They did inherit a lot of gardens there. But they did seem to think of gardens much more that you would go for your evening outing and you would drive around. And of course, Lady Willingdon, who put her stamp on so many things. In the funny way, I think what jumps out at you now so much, more than the gardens in Delhi, are the roundabouts in New Delhi proper, that is in the posher sections. And the landscaping along those avenues where there are the well-to-do houses, those colonies where the civil servants live, where the diplomatic corps live, and the landscaping of those, and then the flowers around, or the flowering trees, especially along there. But it is interesting, of course, that the viceroy's house, the Rashtrapati Bhavan, did end up with a so-called Mughal garden. And I think that was, again, the influence of Lady Harding, who, and there's another one. She obviously took a real interest in Indian gardens. She didn't want to replicate Buckingham Palace or one of those. And I think, and it seems pretty clear that she was familiar with the work of Constance Villiers Stewart, who was making, in her history, was also very much an agenda for restoring the old garden craft, the Indian knowledge, and making clear to people what it consisted of. It really was the first comprehensive work, and I think tremendously important in his time. And she was the wife of an official. So there again, you find one of these exceptions, somebody who really was interested in looking at Indian traditions for their own sake, and then taking an activist role to see if they'd be preserved. And she very much hoped that New Delhi would incorporate a lot of that, including restoration of things that had been just devastated in old Delhi. And I think what was very sad was the destruction of Chandni Chowk and those things in old Delhi, as well as the creation of New Delhi, which for all Mughal garden talk there is really essentially a British garden city, more than any British garden city that ever got built, because nobody ever had the free hand and the resources that Lutyens had. It is really quite extraordinary because there are garden cities, but they're very modest in England and usually compromised by competing interests. And so, and the gardens, I was thinking of the older gardens, the Lodi Gardens and others that I'm familiar with. Well, of course, then so many of them are monuments as well as gardens. Humayun's tomb, the Lodi Gardens, they're all built around tombs. And I think the restoration has been very much along the lines of the Taj, with gravel paths and some trees and, in some cases running water. But the last time I was there, Humayun's tomb didn't even have any running water in the channels. I think it was before the Commonwealth Games, and I think they were saving up for the Commonwealth Games to finally restore the fountains and the channels then. But and the Red Fort gardens, too, are mostly pretty much lawn and a few shade trees. And even when they've restored them, they haven't raised the paths the same way. You don't get the sense of looking down on a pattern that you would have in a Mughal garden. You just look down on grass, essentially.
You mentioned the term garden imperialism in the closing chapter.
Yeah.
What exactly We've seen that, because you mentioned that was not just the British, but it was also other imperial powers who went about creating their own gardens. And I mean, what about the differences, let's say, between British gardens in India and maybe, like, you know, British gardens elsewhere in other colonies?
Yeah, I think, well, I think because India was the jewel in the crown, that you find everything in its most extreme form in India, because they were there longer than other places. There are many more of them, and it was so important to them. But botanical, I've had friends say, oh, you should see the botanical gardens in Sydney, and I've seen the gardens in Vancouver, say, and it's a lot the same sort of thing, that where they went. At first it was domestic gardens, mm-hmm. then it would be botanical gardens and parks, all of those following their aesthetic, because that, especially, it was their urban aesthetic. They couldn't imagine a city without parks, and I think that's very commendable, and it strikes me that Indians, at least, I've never been to Australia, but Indians appreciate the parks, whether it's the Rajpath on a sunny with the green swards on the side and the water and the paths for jogging or horseback riding, that sort of thing, that they have imported a whole kind of a concept of leisure, for one thing, and leisure focused on nature, or in an urban setting, it becomes parks. If you can't get out of the city, and it's harder and harder to get out of the city. So I think that's a common phenomenon, but I do think it's writ large in India, because it was
obviously, the whole British style of gardening, it left a considerable legacy in terms of how ordinary Indians went about gardening.
Yes. Well, one of my favorites, and I haven't been able to meet her, it was a chance encounter with her daughter-in-law, this woman Sujaya, who's the retired civil servant. And I loved her letters about how she had, growing up in the south of it, in the Kerala, that she had loved British authors, Jane Austen, Daphne du Maurier, and others, so that she was steeped that literature and gardens went together in the English tradition, well, especially since the 19th century, 19th, 20th. And then trying to grow them. And, of course, Kerala didn't have a tradition of English gardens at all. And as far as I can figure out, not that strong a colonial presence. It was only when she got to the north of India, to Delhi, where she was working, and then when they acquired a place in Shimla, that she could really go to town, especially in Shimla, in creating an English garden. And I find it so nice when people can get beyond politics. When you can separate some of those things, that you're not betraying, you know, your country by having by loving English flowers. And
yeah.
So I think didn't see the conflict. I just object that if something good comes of the other horrors of something, that you can't make the most of it. You don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And so, and of course, I loved Seth, and I love the figure of Mrs. Mahesh Kapoor in The Suitable Boy, because she is so downtrodden, and everybody takes advantage of her, and yet in the end she triumphs, her garden triumphs, everybody else comes to a bad end, but not the garden.
So do you think your future research would look at something like this?
Well, what I've been working on now is Sri Lanka, some British Ceylon, looking at the role of gardens there. And the differences are as interesting as the similarities, because from the beginning it was a plantation economy, whereas the plantation wala had a very tricky position in British society and not very high up. But from the beginning it was coffee and then tea, rubber, cinchona in Sri Lanka. So it's quite different. And there, what I was focusing on is the role of the main botanical garden at Peridania as a resource. They had some extraordinary directors, and of course they needed them, because you hear they have this coffee boom and then the sun collapsed in the 1880s, so that they were devastated and people were mortgaged to the hills. It was a little like what's going on now with, like, the defaults and that sort of thing. So I'm thinking of just doing an essay on Peridania and the creation of colonial culture in Sri Lanka, and well, in Ceylon as it was, and contrasting it some with India. And there, so in the garden, the British gardens, they did have their gardens, and they had the equivalent of the hill stations in the hilly areas around Norelia, especially. So there are some parallels. I don't think I would do a whole book on that, because I think that there are just a couple of points to be made, and not as many avenues to go down as with, it seemed to be, with a book on India. But I think that's what I would look at, because I like this idea of a very concrete avenue into a larger cultural phenomenon. And I think it fits there with the plantation economy, but also the sidelight of then how people adapt, how they create a way of life, which interests me, and their individuals. Sorry.
So in that, do you see any parallels emerging with the Dutch East Indies?
Don't know that much about them. They certainly had their gardens, and they certainly had commercial interests in growing out of them. And of course, over and over again, they undercut what the British were doing too. Cinchona failed because the Java could produce it cheaper, coffee to some extent, and then rubber in Malaysia, but though that was not Dutch. But I think. And there are descriptions, too, during the Dutch period in Ceylon of their residences. But one point that some of the first the British arrived at the very end of the 18th century remark on is that the Dutch didn't want to go outside. They didn't have the sweeping verandas and the kind of permeability of English architecture eventually in India. They closed themselves in. So they would have some gardens, but I don't know what, there may be differences between Ceylon, Java, other areas that I really haven't gone into that much. They certainly had gardens, and the French had gardens, no doubt about it. But I just don't think they loomed as large, because their imperial role was not as long lasting or as sweeping as the British. So it's a matter of scale to some extent. And I think there is something unique about the importance of gardens. Not that they are not important to many other people, but I think the British, with their obsession with gardens, there's something unique about that surpasses other countries. And people have great fun trying to speculate why they turn it into a moral issue, which I don't think the Dutch and the French did. That there's something morally uplifting and something good for your character about having a garden.
That was fascinating. That was amazing. But I'm afraid we've taken up a lot of your time now. So we are going to have to close this.
Fine.
But thank you very much for doing this for the New Books Network. And do keep us updated, because we'd love to have you around again for some of your other work.
Okie doke. Well, thanks so much. I've enjoyed it. It's been fun corresponding with you.
So, Fox, a lovely podcast about an unregarded and unstudied facet of British life in India. Colonial gardening legacy persists yet in the official gardens and botanical gardens dotted across the subcontinent centers of power. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Goodbye.